The travois of several horses were laden with the results of the hunt. Deer, elk, wild turkey, and other game. It had been a good hunt, and Quintana led the hunting party back to the village. He was thinking of the celebration they would have on their return. The meat would be put on spits and turned slowly over a fire, and the smell would cause everyone's appetite to grow. They would tell stories of the hunt, and some of the older men would speak of the early days when buffalo were plentiful. Quintana could remember when, as a young boy, he had gone on a buffalo hunt. That had been one of the last hunts to actually take a buffalo, because the herds were all gone now. For hundreds of years, the buffalo had served the Comanche. Then the white men had come, and within one lifetime, the buffalo were gone. None of the others were thinking about the vanished buffalo, though. They were thinking only about the last 2 days and the success of their hunt. They talked about it, reliving certain shots and honing the stories they would tell around the campfires. Everyone bragged of their exploits, except Quintana.
Quintana, have you no stories to tell? We are all waiting to hear how it is that you killed only one half of an elk. Is the back half still running around somewhere in the woods, waiting to be taken at the next hunt?
I will tell my story when there are better ears to hear it, Tecano. Such a story to ears as yours would be a terrible waste.
Quintana, look ahead. There is smoke. Is it a forest fire?
The hunting party stopped for a moment to study the smoke.
I think it is not a forest fire. If many trees were burning, there would be much more smoke.
Grass, perhaps.
Perhaps it is grass. Though it does not seem to me that the smoke is wide enough for a grass fire.
Then what is the cause of this strange thing?
I don't know.
Quintana urged his horse ahead, and the hunting party followed him, riding quickly toward the smoke that rose before him. Though he didn't share it with the others, there was something about this that he found extremely troubling. Then, when they reached the meadow where the village had been, Quintana realized what was bothering him. This was his dream come to life, his worst fear realized. Ahead of him, he saw several blackened circles. He also saw about 50 people moving through the pall of smoke. He wasn't close enough to see whether or not they were crying, but he knew without a doubt that they were. Then, he saw something that he had not seen in his dreams, even though he had always known they were there. He saw several bodies stretched out on the ground. Quintana slapped his legs against the side of his horse. When he arrived, he leaped down from his horse and started searching for Sashina.
Ah, Sashina! Sashina, where are you?
Quintana, your woman and your child are here.
The old man who called him was Isataka, Sashina's grandfather. Quintana looked down at the two bodies. The baby's head had been smashed like a gourd. Sashina's face was deformed by the effect of the bullet that had ended her life. With grief and confusion in his eyes, Quintana looked up at Isataka, who had summoned him.
Who? Who did this?
It was white soldiers.
Soldiers? Soldiers of the white man's army did this?
Yes. They came before light this morning and began firing. Stone Eagle was going to reason with them, to ask them why they are doing this thing. But they shot him down before he could get to them. Then there was much confusion. Some of us got away during the confusion, and we hid in the forest and watched as they slaughtered those who did not get away.
Suddenly, Quintana recalled his conversation with Smoke Jensen. Jensen had told him that someone had attacked the family of a white rancher.
I think I know why the white soldiers attacked.
Why?
The home of a white rancher was attacked, and the rancher's wife and children were killed. According to the sign left, the attack was made by Comanche.
That cannot be true. There are no Comanche on the warpath.
We know that, but the whites do not. And I can think of no other reason why they would attack our village.
I think they do not need a reason. There is an evil in the white man that cannot be kept down. It has been many years since there was any trouble between our people. Perhaps the evil could wait no longer.
A grief-stricken Tecano came to stand beside Quintana.
Quintana! We must do battle with the white man!
Like Quintana, Tecano had lost his wife. He had also lost two children.
We can't fight the white man. There are too many of them. There are as many white men as there are blades of grass. If we make war against them, we will all be killed.
Better to be killed fighting than to die a coward. And that is what we will be if we do nothing.
We will do something.
What? What will we do, Quintana?
I will talk with the spirits. It is for the spirits to decide what we must do.
Quintana buried his wife and child, then went into the mountains to consult with the spirits. He took neither water nor food with him, for the nourishment he sought was for his soul, not his body. And to nourish his soul, he took a supply of peyote buttons. He went high into the mountains above the snow line, and there he sat, wrapped in a buffalo robe, looking out over the valley below. He didn't know how long he had been there when he saw a warrior mounted on a horse. The warrior was wearing a headdress of many feathers that stretched all the way to the ground. He also wore a shirt and trousers of beaded buckskin, and there was a glow around him that was so bright that it hurt Quintana's eyes to look at him.
Shining Warrior!
Shining Warrior looked at Quintana for a moment, but he didn't speak. The warrior urged his horse into a gallop. Shining Warrior rode for some distance away, then turned and rode back toward Quintana. As he galloped toward him, Shining Warrior held his war club over his head and leaned to one side as if he were going to strike Quintana. Quintana was frightened, but he knew instinctively that he must not flinch. Shining Warrior swung the club at Quintana's head and stopped it just inches from smashing his skull. Then Quintana noticed a very strange thing. Even though the horse had galloped back and forth across the snow-covered plain, it left no tracks, except for the footprints Quintana had left. That snow was completely pristine. Shining Warrior leaned down then to put his hand on Quintana's forehead. Quintana shut his eyes, and when he did, he saw a vision of what was left of his people. In the vision, he saw that his people were being attacked yet again by soldiers.
No!
When Quintana opened his eyes, Shining Warrior was gone. There was no sign of his having been there at all, for the snow was still undisturbed. And now, amazingly, even his own footprints were gone. There had not been a fresh snowfall, yet the surface of the snow was brilliantly white, fresh, clean, and absolutely unblemished. The Indians were still cleaning up the mess of what had been their village when Quintana returned from his sojourn into the mountains. He was met by Tecana and others.
You have returned?
Yes.
And did you have a vision?
Yes. Tecana, Shining Warrior came to me.
Shining Warrior? Your medicine is very strong. I have known many who wish to see him, but I have known none who have. What did he look like?
Like a warrior of old. He looks like the warrior who visited Comanche in the story Stone Eagle told.
What did he say to you?
He did not speak.
He came to you, but he did not speak?
He did not speak to me with words, but he made me see here and here.
Quintana touched his forehead and his heart. By now, the other young men had gathered to hear what Quintana was saying.
When we ride on the path of war, our horses will leave no sign. Not even the most skilled of trackers will be able to find us.
All creatures leave tracks. Even an ant leaves a track.
A bird leaves no track because it does not touch the ground. We will be like the bird. The hooves of our horses will not touch the ground.
How can this be? How can our horses travel without touching the ground?
I do not know. But Shining Warrior showed me that it could be done.
When Tana described the amazing sight of seeing Shining Warrior's horse galloping back and forth, yet leaving no mark upon the snow. Then he told how his own tracks had disappeared, even though there was no snowfall to cover them.
Perhaps it will appear to us as if our horses are touching the ground, but the sign will be invisible to everyone else.
Yes. If Shining Warrior has said it will be so, then I believe it will be so.
Quintana looked over to where the survivors were busy rebuilding as much of their village as they could.
What are they doing?
Tecano took in the village with a motion of his hand.
Look, the village still lives. The lodges that weren't burned by fire have been put up again. And soon, new lodges will take the place of those that were destroyed.
No, our people must not rebuild here. We must move the village.
Why?
In my vision, I saw more soldiers come to this place. Many more of our people were killed.
If you have seen it in your vision, then it is to be so. And there's nothing we can do about it.
I do not believe this. I believe that I was shown the vision so that it could be changed. If the village is moved, then the soldiers cannot find it.
We will move our people. Did Shining Warrior show you how we would get guns?
No. But I believe a way to get the guns will be shown to us.
Even as Quintana made that statement, they saw two riders approaching. Two of the hunters, still angry and grief-stricken, raised their bows and drew the strings to shoot the visitors. But Quintana held out his hand to stop them.
Wait! These are not soldiers. We will see what they want.
As the two riders came closer, the villagers saw that they were Indians. As they approached, the riders held up their right hands, palms out, in a sign of peace. Quintana returned the sign as a signal that they could enter without fear.
I am Perry Blue Horses.
The rider pointed to the man.
This is Russell Swiftbear.
You have white and Indian names.
We have white and Indian blood.
Blue Horses looked around at the destroyed village.
This was done by the white man?
Yes.
I am shamed by my white blood.
All the men were away. When we returned, we learned that soldiers had attacked our village and killed our women and children and our old men.
Are you at war with the whites?
I think we are at war now. For many years, our people and the whites have been at peace. We lease our land to white ranchers so they may graze their cattle. We keep the money they pay us in the white man's bank. But some people attacked and killed a white rancher and his family. The whites think we did it.
What? A ranch was attacked? When did this happen? I know nothing of this.
I think it happened a short time ago.
Then we must go to the whites and tell them that we did not do such a thing. Perhaps then there will be no war.
I think they will not listen.
Will you make war against the white men who did this?
When we went away to hunt, we hunted in the old way, with the bow and arrow, as did our ancestors. Our rifles and bullets stayed behind. Now all our guns are gone, taken by the white soldiers when they attacked.
We can get weapons for you.
How?
Because of our blood. We can do business with the white man.
Quintana smiled broadly and looked at the others.
Did I not say that Shining Warrior would show the way?
Get guns for us. Rifles and bullets. We will need these things.
50 rifles with bullets will cost $2,500 in white man's money.
How can we pay this? Our money is in the white man's bank.
It is your money. Go to the bank and take it out.
All right. I will get the money. When will we get the guns?
I will talk to the one who has them. We will come with the guns when you have the money.
As Blue Horses and Swift Bear rode away, the others gathered around Quintana.
Quintana, you will get the money?
Yes, I will get the money.
If you lead, we will follow.
The citizens of the small town of Stonewall weren't particularly surprised to see an Indian riding into town. The Indians frequently did business in the town, and though they had heard that renegades attacked a ranch over near Big Rock, they certainly didn't expect any trouble from their Indians. After all, the Indians did a great deal of their business in Stonewall. Everything from keeping their money on deposit in the Stonewall Bank to buying goods from the local merchants. And because the Indians spent freely, the merchants often went out of their way to make certain that the Indians understood that their money was welcome in the town stores. The Indians had money because their great chief, Quanta Parker, had negotiated the grazing rights for all Comanches and Kiowa within a 240,000 square mile area. With millions of acres to work with, Quanta Parker had arranged to lease pasturage to wealthy stockmen so they could run their cattle on Indian land. That brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. And though the village of Quintana was much smaller and had less land to lease, their percentage was enough to provide an income for every Comanche in the village. Quintana was extremely cautious as he rode into town. Although he had made a deal to buy rifles for $2,500, he had discussed the issue with Tecano, and they decided that he had better take $5,000 from the bank. They'd come to that decision because they didn't know when, or even if, they would get another chance to make a withdrawal. They had even discussed taking all their money from the bank, but decided that if they did that, there might be some sort of negative response to their action. And until all was ready, they wanted to minimize any chance of trouble with the whites. If all whites believed that the Comanche were responsible for the attack on the ranch, then even the citizens of Stonewall, who were normally very receptive, might be antagonistic, and an attempt to close the account could set them off. Quintana also realized that the citizens of Stonewall might already consider themselves at war, so he was observant of everyone and everything. He kept his eyes on the roofs and second floors of the buildings, looking for any would-be shooters. To his surprise, no one seemed particularly interested in him. He stopped in front of the bank, looped the reins around the hitching post, then went inside. There was still no reaction. But how could this be? Surely they had heard of the raid against his people by the soldiers. And yet they gave no indication that anything was other than normal. Quintana stepped up to the teller's window.
Yes, sir. And what can the Bank of Stonewall do for our Indian customers today?
I want to sign paper to get $5,000.
$5,000? Oh, my, that's a great deal of money.
Checking a ledger, he looked up and smiled.
However, your village does have enough money in the account to cover it. In fact, you have much more than that. But in order to withdraw from the account, you will have to have the signature of either Mr. Running Deer or Mr. Stone Eagle. I'm afraid they are the only two names on the signature card.
Dead.
I beg your pardon?
Running Deer and Stone Eagle are dead.
Both of them?
Yes.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, this does complicate things.
I am Quintana. I will sign paper for money.
Mr. Quintana, I'm afraid that won't do. You can't get the money.
It is money of the Indian people of my village, is it not?
Yes, indeed it is. But, surely you understand that in order to keep just any Indian from coming in here and getting the money, only certain people are authorized to make a withdrawal. It is for your own protection, and the only ones who can take the money from the account are Mr. Running Deer and Mr. Stone Eagle.
Dead.
So you told me. Wait here for a moment while I go back to talk to Mr. Freeman. I'm sure he'll know what to do.
The teller left the window and walked to the back of the bank to speak to an older man who was sitting behind a desk. As he spoke, he pointed back toward Quintana, and the man at the desk looked up toward Quintana. Quintana saw the man, whom the teller had identified as Mr. Freeman, shake his head and then go back to work. The teller returned to the window.
I'm sorry, Mr. Quintana, but Mr. Freeman says we can't give the money to you. Now, if you will have Mr. Running Deer or Mr. Stone Eagle come into the bank, we will be glad to give them as much money as there is in the account.
They are dead.
Yes. But they are the only ones who can withdraw the money, you see?
Quintana nodded then, without further comment, and he turned and walked away. Outside the bank, Quintana had just started to mount his horse when he saw the stock of a rifle protruding from the saddle holster of another horse that was tied to the same hitching rail. Without a second thought, Quintana pulled the rifle from its scabbard, jacked around into the chamber, then went back inside. Quintana jacked another shell into the rifle, then stepped up to the same window he had been at before.
Give me money.
Yes, sir.
With shaking hands, the teller began taking money from his cash drawer and stuffing it into the pouch.
I don't want all money. I only want $5,000 of Indian money.
$5,000? Yes, sir.
Write on paper that I, Quintana, took $5,000 of Indian money.
Yes, sir.
Quickly and with nervous hands, the banker did as he was instructed. Quintana signed the paper, then taking the money pouch, he backed out of the bank, pointing the rifle at everyone inside. Once outside, he jumped onto his horse and rode out of town. Joe Mayberry, editor of the Big Rock Sentinel, removed the paper from the press, then took it over to the composition table to look at it. Big Rock was the fourth town in which Joe had started a newspaper. Joe had a history of coming into town, starting a newspaper, then when the paper was going well, getting restless, selling it, and moving on. An indication of how solid a newspaper man Joe was the fact that all of the previous newspapers were still going, being run by the people who had bought Joe out. Joe wasn't afraid to take an unpopular stand, and often upset his readers with his pointed editorials. He had the notion that this particular editorial was going to be one of those.
Was the raid on the Indian village necessary? All of Big Rock, if not the entire state, knows about the tragic attack against the ranch of Tom Burke. And while most suspect that Indians were responsible for the attack, nearly everyone concedes that the attack had to be carried out not by the law-abiding Indians we have come to know over the last several years, but by renegade Indians. Last week, Sam Covington, in his recently appointed guise as a colonel in the state militia, led a company of volunteer cavalry in a raid against Purgatory, the Comanche village that is nearest Big Rock. The number of Indians killed was quite substantial, whereas not one of Colonel Covington's men received so much as a scratch. Colonel Covington is hailing it as a very big victory. But how big a victory is it? It is now known that most, if not all, of the Indians killed were women, children, and the elderly. There were no young men present at the time of the attack. Therefore, the attack was virtually unopposed. What that means is, the Battle of Purgatory wasn't a battle at all. It was a slaughter. A slaughter of helpless and innocent Indians. Yes, I said innocent. For even if those scoundrels who raided the Burke Ranch were Indians, they were acting on their own. And a peaceful Indian village shouldn't be any more responsible for their outlaws than we are for ours. If justice is to be done here, let it be done against those who are truly responsible for the evil deeds done. For to do otherwise is to shift the evil from the Indians to ourselves.
When Covington finished reading the article, he wadded the newspaper up and threw it into his trash can. The campaign against the Indians had not generated the kind of publicity Covington had hoped it would. It was barely mentioned in the newspapers in the state, and when it was mentioned, The articles were often as unflattering as this editorial was. He wasn't sure that any out-of-state paper had carried any news from the campaign. Why this was, he had no idea. It wasn't too long ago that every Indian campaign, regardless of how small it might be, would receive national coverage. In fact, people were still talking about Custer's debacle, and that was over 10 years ago. As a matter of fact, from the intensity of the interest in Custer still ongoing, Covington was willing to bet that they'd be talking about the Battle of Little Bighorn 100 years from now. So why weren't they discussing the Battle of Purgatory? Unlike the Battle of Little Bighorn, where every soldier in Custer's command had been killed, in the Battle of Purgatory, Covington had not lost one man. By all that was right, Covington should be regarded as a hero throughout the state. Maybe he just wasn't well enough known yet.
Yes, that has to be it.
So what could he do about it? Maybe he could arrange a speaking tour, telling of the dangers everyone in the state was facing today by being so complacent about the Indians. Yeah, that would do it. He'd write to Denver and secure the governor's sponsorship for a tour of the state. He knew that some photos had been taken out on Timber Notch Ranch. He could use those gruesome photos to arrange a magic lantern show to illustrate his talk. And he would call his talk
The Cost of Neglect.
He would use the graphic photographs to illustrate what could happen due to a lack of vigilance with regard to the Indians. At that moment, Covington's musing was interrupted by Dingo.
Yes, First Sergeant? What can I do for you?
I was just wondering if you'd heard about what happened over in Stonewall.
Something happened at Stonewall? No. What happened?
The Indians come to a bank, guns blazing. Then they robbed it.
You don't say. The Indians, you say? Are you sure?
Yes, sir. I'm sure.
Where did you hear this?
Why, you can hear about it all over town. And they're especially talking about it over in Longmont Saloon.
Has Sheriff Carson gotten word of it?
Reckon he has. I figure that's how everyone else found out about it.
He got word, and he didn't tell me. That's not right. The sheriff is obligated to tell me of any incident involving Indians. I think perhaps it is time I paid a little visit to our noble sheriff.
Yes, sir. I thought you might be interested in doing that.
What do you mean, why weren't you informed? It was a bank robbery. It has nothing to do with you.
Oh, but I'm afraid it does, Sheriff. You see, if the Indians robbed...
It wasn't Indians. It was one Indian. And the funny thing is, he didn't really rob the bank.
What do you mean he didn't rob the bank? You just told me that he did rob it.
Technically, I suppose he did, in that he took the money without proper authority. However, the money he took, $5,000, was from the Indian's own account. He tried to write a draft for the money, but he couldn't because the only two men authorized to sign for the money, Stone Eagle and Running Deer, were both dead. You killed them, Covington.
Are you telling me the Indians had $5,000 in their account?
Oh, yes. From what I understand, they had nearly $15,000 in the account. Quintana merely tried to make a withdrawal, and when they wouldn't give the money to him, he took it at gunpoint. And get this, he didn't rob them. He just forced them to accept his draft.
Yes, well, it doesn't matter. If the person who took the money isn't on the signature card, then the draft is not valid. And if the draft isn't valid, then taking the money at gunpoint is bank robbery. He did take it by force, didn't he?
I'll be damned, Covington, if you don't look happy about it.
I'm happy only in that it will wake the people up. I think everyone needs to be aware of the dangers the Indians still present to the peaceful citizens of this great state.
Bullplop. You're just wanting an excuse to man another campaign against them. Only, I don't think you'll be able to steal anything from them this time.
Steal from them?
That's what you did, isn't it?
It is not what I did. I made a legal confiscation of contraband.
Uh-huh. And if you had done that anywhere other than an Indian reservation, I'd have you in jail right now.
Yes, well, that's the point, isn't it? I did do it on an Indian reservation.
I don't know what you plan to take from them now. I'm sure that the Indians don't have anything left. I heard that, in addition to everything else, you also stole $1,000 in cash from them.
As I informed you, Sheriff, the money wasn't stolen. It was part of the legal spoils of war.
Spoils of war?
You say it was Quintana who took the money from the bank?
Yes. But for the life of me, I can't see why you are so interested. Even if it was a bank robbery, and there is some question as to whether it was, it is a civil affair and has nothing to do with you.
It does if Quintana's action is a direct result of the punitive raid we conducted against Purgatory. And such a reaction on the part of a principal member of the village means that the issue is still unsettled. I'm afraid this moves things to the next step.
The next step? What do you mean, the next step?
Sheriff Carson, it is my unpleasant but necessary duty to inform you that as of now, Big Rock and all of Las Animas and Costilla counties are and will continue to be until further notice under martial law. From now on, you, your deputies, the mayor, and the city council will be responsible to me. No city or law enforcement business can or will be conducted without my express permission.
What? Have you gone crazy? You can't declare martial law.
Oh, but I can. And I have. My commission from the governor is very specific about that. If you have any questions, contact the governor.
You are doing all this because of the act of one Indian?
Indians are like cockroaches, Sheriff. Where there is one, there are many. Oh, please inform the mayor of my decision to declare martial law.
I shall do so. I shall definitely do so.
Covington left a frustrated and disgusted sheriff behind as he walked quickly down the street to the telegraph office.
Oh, what can I do for you, Mr. Covington?
It is Colonel Covington, for the duration.
Duration? Duration of what?
The Indian uprising. But as for what you can do for me, I have a few regulations I am putting into effect.
Go ahead.
Effective immediately. You will send no telegram unless the sender has my express written permission.
What? Well, I can't do that.
Also, no telegram will be delivered to anyone in town without my clearance. That means that all incoming telegrams must come to me first.
Mr. Covington!
I told you, it is Colonel.
Colonel Covington, I can't do what you ask. The rules and regulations of Western Union are quite specific. Our customers have the absolute right of privacy of communication. If we start running all incoming and outgoing messages through some official somewhere, people will no longer trust us.
That's Western Union's problem, not mine. You will do what I say, or I will close your office.
Yes, sir.
Leaving the Western Union office, Covington made his next stop, the Big Rock Sentinel. Joe Mayberry was sitting at the composing desk, setting type. Because his back was to the door, he didn't see who came in.
If you have a news story, put it in the basket on the right. If it's an ad, put it in the basket on the left.
It is neither.
What is it, Covington?
I did not appreciate the editorial you wrote about our operation. You impugned the action of many brave men.
Brave? What is so brave about going into a village in the middle of the night and killing sleeping women, children, and old men?
I wouldn't expect someone like you to understand. This is a military matter. What do you know of the military?
Sonny, where were you in the first week of July 1863?
July 1863? Why, I don't know. Anyway, what is so significant about that date?
I was at Gettysburg with the 1st Missouri Brigade. And unlike your midnight murder, Gettysburg was a real battle.
All right, you were at Gettysburg. I admit that those who fought at Gettysburg may have faced more danger than we faced at the Battle of Purgatory. But unless you have had a command of your own, I still submit that you aren't qualified to discuss things of a military nature.
Oh, I had a command.
You had a command? What was your command?
The 1st Missouri Brigade.
Yes, yes, you told me that. What was your command within the brigade?
The brigade was my command.
You are a brigadier general?
I used to be a brigadier general. Now I'm a newspaper man. Now are you here just to complain about my editorial? Or have you something else in mind? What are you doing here?
For a moment, it looked as if Covington was still trying to absorb the fact that this man who published a weekly newspaper in a small Colorado town was once a brigadier general in the greatest war in America's history.
I asked, what are you doing here? What do you want?
Oh, yes. I want you to print an announcement for me. Effective immediately, all of Las Animas and Costilla counties are under martial law.
Martial law? Why?
I should think the reason would be obvious to you, Mr. Mayberry. We are in the midst of an Indian uprising. Martial law is necessary to protect the lives of our citizens.
What exactly are the terms of this martial law?
Well, to begin with, I am establishing a 10 p.m. curfew. No guns can be carried within the city limits. No guns can be sold without my permission. All legal matters, both criminal and civil, will come through my office. The text of all telegrams sent and received must be approved by me. Any gathering of 10 or more people shall be construed as an unlawful assembly, and those participating in such a gathering will be arrested.
Are you going to arrest people for going to church?
Churches are exempt.
That's big of you. Schools?
Yes, of course. Schools are also exempt.
What about Longmont's? On a good night, he'll have as many as 40 patrons. Are you going to close Longmont's?
I will allow Longmont's to stay open in order to conduct its normal business. But the patrons of Longmont's will be put on notice that they will not be permitted to conduct a meeting of any sort. And the establishment will be closed by 10 p.m.
You don't really expect to make any of this stick, do you?
I do indeed. And finally, Mr. Mayberry, I want it understood by you that any article you print from now on is subject to military censorship.
What? You can't do that! That is a direct violation of the First Amendment!
Disabuse yourself of any idea that you are covered by the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Those are elements of civil law and authority. Big Rock is now under military law and authority. Those personal rights normally guaranteed are withdrawn for the duration of the Indian emergency. I have the authority to prevent assemblies, suspend habeas corpus, close church and school, ban firearms, and censor the press. And I intend to do just that. Do I make myself clear, Mr. Mayberry?
Painfully clear.
Good. See to it that this information is published at once. Don't wait for your next issue. Get an extra edition out.
Before nightfall that very day, an extra edition of the Sentinel was published and distributed. In addition, Covington had signs printed and posted all over town.
To all seeing these greetings, be it known that a state of emergency exists between our citizens and hostile Indians, resulting in a declaration of martial law to be administered by Samuel Covington, Colonel CMNDG.
Quintana and Takano watched as Blue Horses and Swift Bear rode toward them, leading two pack horses. Word spread quickly that the weapons had arrived. And by the time the two gunrunners were on the scene, nearly all the young men of Quintana's group had gathered around, waiting anxiously for the opportunity to get their hands on a rifle again. As soon as Blue Horses and Swift Bear arrived, the Indians rushed toward the pack horses and began opening the parcels, disclosing the rifles tied together in bundles of five.
You have kept your promise.
You have the money?
Quintana held out the sack of money he had taken from the bank.
$2,500. That is what you asked for.
Blue Horses took the money as the Indians began unpacking everything.
Quintana, there are not many bullets. There are not even enough bullets to fill all the guns.
Why is this? We have given you much money, all that you asked for.
This was all the bullets we could get this time. But for $1,000 more, we can get many bullets.
You did not speak of $1,000 more. You spoke only of $2,500.
Maybe we will kill you and take the money back.
No. If we are to make war, we will need bullets, and they are the only ones who can bring bullets to us. Bring more bullets, but don't bring them here. We are going to leave this place.
You will have $1,000 more?
Yes.
Where do we bring them?
Do you know the place of Howling Winds?
Howling Winds is high in the mountains, near Ratan Pass.
Yes.
It is not good to go high in the mountains now. There will be much snow there. Nobody goes high in the mountains when there is much snow.
That is why we go. There, our people will be safe from the soldiers. If you want to sell more bullets, you must come there.
As Cal approached the edge of town, two men came out into the road holding up their hands to stop him. They were wearing military uniforms. Curious, Cal hauled back on the reins.
What's going on?
We'll take your gun.
The hell you will. Why should I give you my gun?
It's the law.
I've lived here a long time. I've never heard such a law. In fact, I don't think Sheriff Carson ever even let such a law get passed.
Well, Carson ain't got nothing to do with it. This here town is under martial law.
Martial law? What does that mean?
It means you do exactly what we tell you, or else.
Or else what?
Or else you go to jail. Now, you gonna give us the gun or not?
Take it.
One of the soldiers made a move toward Cal, but almost quicker than he could see it happen, a gun appeared in Cal's hand. The other soldier raised his rifle. Cal's bullet hit the rifle stock right in front of the soldier's hand, causing him to drop the weapon. Both soldiers were stunned into submission.
You put the rifles in the back of the wagon.
One of the soldiers picked up the rifle from the ground and put it and his own rifle into the wagon. Then and only then did Cal feel safe enough to present his back to the two soldiers as he drove into town. He left the buckboard in front of the general store, provided the store with a grocery list, then walked across the street to Longmont Saloon.
Hey, Lewis, what the heck is going on here?
Suddenly, four armed soldiers rushed into the room behind him. All had their guns drawn.
Put your hands up, mister. You are under arrest.
For what?
Shut up!
Sally wasn't too worried when Cal didn't come back right away. He was young and he enjoyed getting into town, so she figured he had found something to occupy his time. When she happened to look outside late in the afternoon, she saw the buckboard coming up the lane. She smiled and stepped out onto the porch, intending to ask Cal if he'd had a good time. But the smile left her face when she saw that the team wasn't being driven. The horses had returned to the ranch on their own. The team headed straight for the barn, then stopped. Sally hurried out to the buckboard and looked around. She saw no sign of foul play, but neither did she see any sign of Cal.
Cal? Cal, are you hiding somewhere, playing a trick on me? Because if you are, it isn't funny.
Sally went over to the horse and patted him gently.
You've been in harness all day, haven't you, boy? Let me get you out of here.
Sally unhitched the team and turned him into the corral. Then she went back inside and changed out of her dress and into a pair of denim trousers and a red wool shirt. She tied up her hair, then covered it with an old felt hat. After strapping on her Colt 44, she topped the ensemble off with a sheepskin coat. The coat not only provided warmth against the brace and chill, it also completed the picture so that on a casual glance, one would think they were seeing a young man. And that was exactly the way Sally wanted it. It was dark by the time she reached Big Rock. She was just riding past Josh Dobbins' livery.
Halt!
Halt? Did you say halt?
Two men dressed as soldiers stepped out of the shadows of the livery.
You packing, mister?
What's going on here?
We're asking the questions. Are you carrying a gun?
Yes.
Take it out real slow-like and drop it in the dirt.
Why should I?
The talkative soldier jacked a shell into the chamber of his rifle.
Because by God, I told you! Now, do you have any more questions?
No, I'd say that pretty well does it for me.
Sally slipped the pistol from its holster and let it fall. She had another one in the pocket of the jacket, but she made no move toward it, nor did she mention it.
In case you're wondering about things, this here town is under martial law.
Martial law?
Yeah. In case you ain't heard, we got us an engine war going on.
No, I haven't heard anything about it.
Colonel Covington, he's done took over everything. Sheriff's office, telegraph office, newspaper even. You gonna spend any time in this town, you better watch your P's and Q's.
Yes, thanks.
And whatever it is that you're doing, best you have done for 10 o'clock. It's curfew.
Sally dismounted in front of Longmont. Ordinarily, she wouldn't go into a saloon alone, especially at night, even a place like Longmont's. But this was not an ordinary situation. Longmont's was doing a brisk business, but it did not look as if anyone was enjoying himself. Rather, the customers were all sitting around with glum expressions on their faces, drinking almost mechanically. Even the bar girls, who normally flitted around like brightly colored butterflies, were sitting together at one table, engaged in quiet conversation. The only animation came from the half dozen or so men who were in military uniforms. As usual, Lewis was sitting at his table in the back of the room. He was playing solitaire, and he dealt three cards face down, then studied the layout in front of him. Sally walked straight to his table.
What can I do for you, mister?
Lewis?
Looking up, Lewis recognized her, and his face became animated, and he started to say something, but was cautioned against it by a small, almost imperceptible nod from Sally.
Sit down, mister.
Sally sat across the table from him.
Lewis, have you seen Cal?
You've got him in jail.
Monty has Cal in jail?
Not Monty, the army. We're under martial law now.
Yes, that's what the men at the edge of town said when I rode in. They took my gun.
One of the first things Covington did was declare that no guns could be carried by anyone but members of the militia.
What about Monty? Where does he fit into all this?
He doesn't fit. In fact, he's not even in town now. He took the afternoon train to Denver to see the governor.
Why didn't he just send a telegram?
No telegrams can come or go without Covington's permission.
Why is Cal in jail? What did he do?
As far as I know, the only thing he did was not give up his gun when they asked for it.
Smoke gave him that gun. He's not likely to give it up to anyone without a fight. I'm going to get him out. Do you know if his bail has been set?
Bail? I doubt if Covington will allow bail.
Well, bail or no bail, I'm going to get him out. I can't let him stay there.
How do you plan to do that?
I don't know yet. But if you've got any ideas, I'd be more than happy to listen to them.
I've got one idea.
15 minutes later, Lewis Longmont was standing in the dark just outside town, behind an old tannery building. The building was unoccupied now, and it had been for a few years, ever since the tanning operation went out of business. Now there was nothing left of the once thriving business, except four walls and a caved-in roof. Lewis had bought the property and had plans to build a boot store there as soon as he cleared the old building away. Tonight was the night he decided to clear that building away. Lewis was holding a bow and four arrows. Each arrow was wrapped in cloth, and each of the cloth wrappings had been soaked in kerosene. Lewis lit one of the arrows. The arrow described a long, high, beautiful flaming arc across the sky. It landed on what was left of the shake roof of the old tannery building, and almost immediately the building began burning. Another flaming arrow arced through the dark sky.
Indian!
Lewis changed positions before he launched the third arrow. A fourth flaming arrow arced across the night sky, and though no one in town realized it, this would be the last arrow of the Indian attack. Suddenly, the militiamen began shooting out into the dark toward the direction from which the arrows had been launched. Lewis was in no danger, however, because by the time the militia got organized enough to return fire, he was gone. He stepped up onto the porch of his saloon.
I see him! There's hundreds of them!
The soldiers fired into the woods just out of town. Now, every shadow was an Indian and every branch a warrior, waiting to take their scalp. As Lewis stepped into the saloon, he saw Covington running up the middle of the street, heading toward his panicked men. Lewis sat back down to the card game.
All right, Sally girl. The rest is up to you.
Sally waited in the dark behind the jail. When she heard the shooting, she moved through the shadows to the jail window.
Cal! Cal, are you in there?
Cal's head appeared in the window.
Sally! What's going on? What's all the shooting?
Don't worry about it. Anyone else in there?
No. Fellows who were here ran outside when the shooting started.
Any other prisoners?
No.
Good. Get away from the wall as far as you can. Take the mattress off your bed and get under it.
What are you gonna do?
Sally held up a stick of dynamite.
I'm going to get you out of here.
Oh, I hope you know what you're doing.
What is there to it besides lighting the fuse?
Sally looked up and saw that Cal was still at the window, watching with great interest.
If I were you, I'd get back.
Oh, shit! I nearly forgot!
Cal scurried to get to the far side of the room while Sally was hurrying to get out of the way, too. A substantial part of the back wall of the jail just came a-tumbling down. Sally ran to the wall, then she started waving her hand against the smoke and the dust.
Cal! Cal, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Let's go.
Cal picked his way through the rubble.
We're going to have to ride double.
Wait!
Wait! Wait for what? We've got to get out of here.
I ain't going nowhere without my pistol. Smoke gave me that pistol, and I'm not leaving it.
Cal, don't be an idiot. We can get it later.
I don't trust these sons of bitches.
Cal moved along the side of the jailhouse, heading for the front.
I'm going to get it back.
All right, get it. But hurry up!
The old tannery was burning fiercely by now, and half the street was lit by the wavering orange glow. Cal sneaked around the corner of the jailhouse, then slipped inside. He jerked open the desk drawer, removed his pistol, and strapped it on.
What are you doing?
Cal looked up to see that one of the men who had been watching the jail was back. He was standing in the door, pointing his gun at Cal.
Well, get back in the...
The man saw the entire back wall gone from the jail.
What the hell? How did that...
There, behind the soldier, stood Sally, her pistol in her hand.
Come on, let's go. I don't know how long he'll be out.
Oh, you're really something, Sally. If you weren't already married, and if you weren't so old, I'll marry you.
Old? How'd you like to walk home?
I was teasing, Sally. I was just teasing.
Hurrying out front, both of them mounted Sally's horse. Even though it was carrying double, that horse responded quick. They were out of town before anybody even knew they were gone. Jack Tatum lay on a flat rock halfway up a hill that overlooked a stage depot known as Miller's Switch, named after Tony Miller, the man who ran it. He watched as the stage from Stonewall to San Luis pulled into the station. Even when the stage was several hundred feet away, he could see the horses' sides heaving and the clouds of steam from their nostrils, evidence of the effort they had pulling the stage up the long hill. The driver brought the team to a halt, then set the brake. A middle-aged, heavyset man came out of the way station to meet him. The shotgun guard climbed down as well, leaving his gun under the seat. When the coach door opened, four passengers got out, three women and a man. From his position on the rock, Tatum watched them cross the yard toward the main building, where they were met at the door by a woman wearing an apron. Two liverymen who worked at the way station joined Tony then, and the three of them started unhooking the horses so they could change the team. Tatum slid back down from his position on the rock.
What's it look like down there?
Well, it looks like we're gonna have chicken and dumplings for dinner.
Well, it's good, because I'm getting plenty tired of beans, I don't mind telling you.
Let's go.
Tatum and the others moved in single file down the narrow trail that led to the road and Miller's Switch below. They rode by the coach, which was now standing empty and devoid of its team, and headed straight toward the corral. Just inside the corral fence, Tony and his two workers had rounded up fresh horses and were just beginning to put them in harness. Tony looked up as the riders approached. The expression on his face showed that in addition to his curiosity as to why they were there, he was also a little wary of them.
Something I can do for you gents?
Yeah, you can die.
Both of the other liverymen started running toward the main house. Hearing the shooting outside, George and his shotgun guard came running out of the way station to see what was going on. Although both had already drawn their pistols, neither one got off a shot.
Let's go get us something to eat.